Joe, this is talking on the 18th of November, 2013, talking about yourself and interactions with the Oxford Medical School. What really made you come to Oxford in the first place?
Well, I had always wanted to work at a teaching hospital and live in the country. Right. And Oxford and Cambridge were the only two places where you could do that in those days. And there was an excellent man in Cambridge doing urology. And I was about to go off to the States for my year doing the BTA. And so I went to see the secretary of the hospital, Jum Burrow, and I said I would be very grateful if he would let me know, because the job wasn't decided a year before I was appointed, and Arthur Elliott Smith was about to retire, and he did the paediatrics and the urology, and they decided to split the job in two. Making both general surgeons, one with an interest in urology and one with an interest in paediatrics. And I got the urological one and Malcolm Goff got the paediatric one. And it's quite important that you know that the British Association of Urological Surgeons had been round the country aiming to adopt pure urology, and therefore on my appointment committee, as it wasn't a purely urological job, they refused to appoint an outside assessor. And they had gone round the centres in the country where they thought there ought to be urology, two people, Mr. Howard Hanley and Professor Leslie Pyra, had gone round talking to people about the need for pure urology and clearly upsetting my general surgical colleagues, particularly Ted Maloney. And so they wouldn't appoint an outside success assessor for this job. And so a chap called Sir Eric Riches, who you know from the Middlesex, he was the outside assessor. He, incidentally, was a general surgeon to the end of his life. I think because if you were senior surgeon at the Middlesex in those days, you automatically got a knighthood, whereas the lesser specialties didn't. And so anyway, that caused me a bit of trouble settling down ruffled feathers, right, when I arrived here. Okay. I had spent the last year in the USA. I was working as a foreign fellow at UCLA.
Right.
And Jum Burrow was as good as his word, and he let me know and sent me the advert for the job. And so I was able to apply, actually, from Los Angeles. And I came back from Los Angeles in February, and the job interview was in March,
right,
to start in April. Now,
The job interview, or...?
The job interview was in March, And so I was home in time, so I didn't need to fly back from America for the interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can remember coming over, and we were living in London at the time. I'd got a temporary job at UCH, where I'd qualified initially. And then, and we were living in London, and I drove over with Mafalda to the Marcus's house in Thame.
Mm-hmm.
The Andrew and Pat were very old friends of ours.
From UCH.
From UCH.
Yeah.
Pat had actually qualified at Barts, but I'd known Andrew.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, he'd looked after me when I'd had TB. And he was in charge of the TB annex.
Right.
And so we were very friendly. And we kept in touch with them. And Mafalda, when we stayed with the Marcuses in Thame, went into the local church and prayed for me to get the job.
Very good.
Which happily I did.
Yes.
And then I started at the beginning of July. I think it was on the 7th, because there had been difficulties with my two senior colleagues, Tim Till and Ted Maloney.
Yeah.
Because they'd been appointed on the same day, and there was continual bickering about who should be senior surgeon, although everybody recognised Tim Till, who was a much nicer man, as a really sensible chap. And he was generally regarded as a senior surgeon. But in order to stop this, because Malcolm Gough was older than I was, they made us start a week apart. So there would be no question about fighting over seniority. Yeah. Because being senior surgeon was quite an important thing in those days.
It was, yes.
Mm.
So this is back in 66?
66.
Yes.
And I started on the 7th of July, 1966. Mm-hmm. And the one way I thought I could establish urology as a distinct specialty was by doing no general surgery in private practice.
Right.
I didn't do any private practice for the first couple of years because I didn't think that was a very good idea. But when we were appointed, I got two sessions with the university.
Yes.
Now, there were two surgeons and three physicians, you were one,
mm-hmm.
appointed at the same time. And the three physicians all got £500 for expenses. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I'd forgotten that, yes. I must say.
And but George Pickering, who dished out the money, didn't think surgeons knew anything about research. And
right.
So we got nothing. Indeed, when we started in private practice, which was largely at the Ackland, Malcolm and I had to buy our own instruments.
Gosh. Wow.
Because those instruments were there, but the general surgeons wouldn't share them.
What would that have cost, roughly, in those days?
I think it was about £600.
Wow, it's a lot of money then.
Quite a lot of money, yes. No, it was quite a lot of money.
Hmm.
And anyway, I thought I would just politely decline general surgical referrals, as this seemed to me the way to slowly build up urological practice. And indeed, the general practitioners around were absolutely marvellous. Mm-hmm. They were particularly Donald Richards.
Yes, in Headington.
He was in Headington, and he recognised that the urology really wasn't up to scratch. And so I used to get a lot of referrals from him, from David Birch, who was in practice in Islip, and from Dick Eager, who was in practice in Burford.
Yes.
And I can remember Chiz Barrett, who said to me, this transurethral resection is prostate is no good.
Right.
And so I said, well, that's not my experience. And every time he sent me a patient and I did a TUR on the patient, I sent him back to him with a little thing, he's dry! Exclamation. And trying to think of the early years, because I was the junior surgeon, very definitely, and there were six surgeons at the time: Tim Till, Ted Maloney, David Tibbs, Charles Webster, and then Malcolm and myself.
Yes, and the professorial team.
And yes, there was the professorial team. And where the reader was Milo Keynes.
Yes.
And Alf Gunning was attached to the surgical unit. And he was a great man, and he would tackle anything.
Yeah, he would. That's right.
I can remember one thing. The one thing I would not tackle was a ruptured aortic aneurysm, because I hadn't done it during my training. And so one time my houseman rang up when we were on duty and said, oh, there's a patient in, we've got a ruptured aortic aneurysm. I said, oh, give Mr. Gunning a ring. Isn't something I've done. And I rang back later, and I said, what's happened to that patient? And the chap said, well, I'm getting theatre ready at 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that. I said, what did Mr. Gunning think about him? Oh, he hasn't seen him.
That was good.
But I managed to establish urology as a separate subject, partly because I was inundated in the outpatients, and partly because I never actually mentioned this to Ted, but any urological cases that came in on our take, I used to keep under my care.
Right.
I had one operating list a week at the Radcliffe on a Wednesday, and two operating lists at the Churchill, one on a Monday, one on a Friday. And it's interesting that David Tibbs, who is the most polite and gentle man, if you meet him, was like a fiend incarnate in the theatre.
Right.
And he used to share, it was the next door theatre, and there were terrible noises coming from there.
So did you have a ward at the Churchill, or beds, rather?
I had beds at the Churchill, and they were shared by Charles Webster, Malcolm Gough, and myself.
And were yours purely urological, then, up there?
Probably.
Yeah,
I I don't think I did, because I had to accept. I didn't turn away general surgery from the outpatients because I regarded myself as a trained general surgeon, which is had rather unusual training, but it was perfectly adequate by the standards of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I used to do the lists, and that's Wednesdays at the Radcliffe, Mondays and Fridays at the Churchill, and Saturday morning I had to do my outpatients because there wasn't an outpatient slot free.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Elliott Smith, Malcolm, took over, and so the only thing left was on Saturday morning. Well, you expect that sort of thing when you start off in a place, I suppose. And I think Mafalda got a bit fed up because I had to go and do an enormous outpatient clinic, and then I would have to go around the wards at the Radcliffe and at the Churchill, and I never got home until tea time on Saturdays.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it was quite tough going.
Different and, from now.
Oh yes, and yes. Sorry.
All right, Joe. You were saying being junior surgeon was a bit difficult.
Well, yes, you just got the worst slot in the outpatient week, and that was all right.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed doing outpatients. I've enjoyed all my working life.
Yes.
And so then gradually the urology built up, and general practitioners who had a wide variety of general surgeons to send their patients to, they gradually stopped sending urology to me. It was a gradual process, and it took several years. Charles Webster was very good at referring urology to me, as was Tim Till.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, and David Tibbs as well, the others less so. But then we gradually built up urology, and I started doing some research. I had to, because I was doing some private practice, and the money went into a university fund.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually, as this built up, I started employing a research chap, and he did some work on rats' kidneys, and I don't think it ever amounted to very much, but he got an MSc out of it.
That's nice. Yes, he was medically qualified.
Oh yes,
yes. No,
yes.
I understand. Yeah,
Paul Hammond, his name was.
Oh, I remember him.
Yes.
When you came to Oxford, you know, after you'd been there a few months, what did you think of the standard compared with America and UCH?
Well, I wasn't very proud of UCH urology at that stage.
Okay.
They had the practice, I think almost uniquely in the London teaching hospitals, of not having specialists. And my urological mentor at UCH was a man called D.R. Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a great expert in parathyroid surgery.
Right.
Because he worked with Charles Dent.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got involved at UCH with the unit that were looking after children with vesicoureteric reflux.
Mm-hmm.
And the leading light in that was Gene Smellie.
Yes, I remember.
And, but Max Rosenheim was in overall charge.
Right.
And I had been doing my thesis before I went to America in the X-ray department with a chap called David Edwards. In those days, it was thought quite dangerous to catheterize patients.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Beeson
mm-hmm.
wrote a great letter, an article on the case against the catheter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thought that you couldn't possibly take a normal person or even a child with urinary infection and catheterize mm-hmm. them. And so the only opportunity that we did, I had, to measure the pressures and flows in the bladder was during the micturating cystogram sessions that David Edwards used to run weekly in the X-ray department.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if I have made one really good contribution, it is to show that small girls did not have obstruction of the urethra. It was easier to show that they were not obstructed than that they were obstructed.
Right.
Because nobody knew about pressures and flows.
Yeah.
Although I had a Swedish friend called Bodo von Gauss, and he had done some splendid work in the 50s measuring pressures and flows, and he came over to England. He spoke beautiful English, and he'd been living with an uncle in England during the war, I think. And he gave me all his work, and I can remember one time he came over and was out at our home in North London having dinner, and he said he'd been up the Thames that
mm-hmm.
day
mm-hmm.
and he'd seen a notice which said Henley Piscatorial Club. Said, "Tell me, Joe, is this an angling club for urologists?"
Splendid. But Joe, does that observation of yours make Gene Smellie's story less likely?
No, because the thing is that people thought in those days, even people like David Innes Williams
mm-hmm.
Thought that there was an obstruction because of the appearance of the urethra during a micturating cystogram,
right.
which was called a spinning top urethra. It went in at the bladder neck and then down at the bottom. And so people thought in those days that obstruction equals infection.
Mm-hmm.
And David Innes Williams had even published a paper on this. And they didn't come from a higher ground than that. And so I then... by showing that there was no obstruction, and I think this appearance, the spinning top urethra, was actually caused because you couldn't, I mean, it's very difficult to get little girls to pee
in a darkened
room in company. And so David Edwards, my colleague in the X-ray department, he had a thing called the Edwards sign, which meant that you had to fill the bladder up until the little girl's toes turned up, and then they would produce it. And it was simply a question of that their bladder was overfull, and it wasn't representing the natural situation at all, but it produced this spinning top urethra. Now, that was being attacked, the spinning top urethra, which was thought to be obstructing, was it was attacked at both ends Some people thought it was an obstruction at the neck of the urethra, and other people thought it was the distal end of the urethra. And the various people in this country were doing a plastic operation on the neck of the bladder, and then other people were doing widening out the distal mm-hmm. urethra. And when I went to the States, they all naturally assumed that infection meant obstruction.
Mm.
And a lot of these, quite a few of these girls, and I saw some of this when I was working at UCLA, were permanently incontinent
yeah.
by the...
I can imagine.
By
yes.
that.
But then, Joe, I can remember the early years, if somebody, an adult, had retention, it was suprapubic catheter, wasn't it?
Well, it hadn't been.
No.
I thought a suprapubic catheter was very much better way
yes,
of doing it.
I remember that.
And I invented a suprapubic catheter. It, yeah. it wasn't much good, but by the standards of the day, it was reasonable. And I used to work with a company who made medical instruments.
Mm-hmm.
They were called Squibb.
Oh, right.
And they worked at High Wycombe.
Right.
And they had a big department there. And I used... And they said to me, look, what should we be doing? I said, you ought to be teaching mm. your sales representatives about basic urology. So I used to go and give lectures to
right.
them, and indeed I...
Was Jeff Fenning there?
Sorry?
Jeff Fenning.
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 V. Remember.
No, fine. But what about the nursing care at Oxford?
Well, the nursing care was splendid, traditional nursing
yes,
care.
Yes.
I suspect rather better than you'd get now. Because I'd been brought up, as you would be, by a generation of sisters who'd lost their fiancés in World War One. And they lived on the wards,
yes.
and they guarded them with a fierce determination. And I remember there was a girl called Mary Wellington, who was always known as Mary Marlborough because she looked after Marlborough Ward,
right.
And she was a splendid lady. And fiercely protective of her patients, and wouldn't let you get away with anything.
And what about the medical students?
Well, the medical students in Oxford have always been very bright, and they were bright then, and I realised that they were much brighter than me, that I could usually keep ahead of them because I'd got a bit of experience under my belt. But
yeah.
they were amazingly bright yeah. and have always been a delight to teach.
Yes. Mm. You don't think there were too many of them towards the end? Because at the beginning there were so few, weren't
there? There were so few.
Yes.
No, when in 66 I remember we used to... students were on your firm for 3 months,
mm-hmm.
and I always used to have them out to the house at the end of their time, and give them a good party.
Yes, good, great. And the operating theatres, what were they like?
Well, do you remember a lady called Eileen Hurley, or Treads?
Yes,
Treads.
Yes, I do, Treads.
And she was the sister in charge of the Radcliffe Theatres. And she used to have a little office just opposite the theatres. Because the changing rooms and the theatres were on either sides of the main Radcliffe corridor.
Yes, that's right.
And Treads I got on very well with. And she was called Treads because she couldn't. She was Irish and couldn't say threads.
Right.
But she used to sit in her little office opposite the theatres, and nobody, she knew everybody yes. who'd gone up and down the thing.
Yes.
I can remember going in one night, that the main corridor of the Radcliffe was in squares of black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember coming in the middle of one night, and one of the cleaners was had a machine, and he was cleaning all the white bits and ignoring the black.
So then when did the new theatres get built? The one sort of the across the road?
Towler Theatres.
Yes.
They were built because Towler was the chairman of the board when I was appointed. He wasn't actually on my appointments committee, although he claimed later he had been. The chap was a rather nice solicitor
right.
who was the deputy
uh-huh.
chairman of the right. hospital. I can't remember his name. And I've forgotten where we started off.
We were on the word about the new theatres, the Tower yes. Theatres.
They came in the early 70s. Mm.
And were they needed, as it were?
Oh, yeah. Well, they were a huge improvement
yes.
on the
yeah.
old ones.
Yes.
But you see, I'd always had quite good theatres at the Churchill
mm-hmm.
Because they were made as part of the American hospital
mm-hmm.
originally, and they were light and airy and had beautiful floors
mm-hmm.
and it was the other chap I think I ought to mention is Frank Ellis.
Yes,
because Frank Ellis was a huge enthusiast.
Yes.
And he was one of the first people I met, apart from the interview, because he invited me out to dinner at the RSM,
mm.
and when I was still living and working in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to play squash with him.
Yes.
And he was then in his 70s,
yeah. Oh, no, 60s.
60s. But because he lived to over 100. Mm. And he, I used to play squash with him, and it was quite embarrassing for me as a young man, because he used to hit the ball after it had bounced twice and carry on as if nothing had happened. And another story about him is that he told me this, and he told me it against himself. He'd been during the war, he was in charge of the radiotherapy department in Sheffield,
mm-hmm.
and then he'd gone to the London hospital,
mm-hmm.
and he used to go when he was in Sheffield. He used to drive his physicist to, they had a facility in Buxton,
mm-hmm.
where they used to go. And I remember one night he was driving me back from London. He was a dreadful driver. Couldn't see where he was going and anything like that. And he told me this story about going up to Buxton, and he'd hit a patch of ice, and the car had spun completely round, but as it was going in the same direction as it had started off, he thought he'd carry on.
Yes.
And the story got back to him in Sheffield through the grapevine that his physicist had said he wasn't going to drive with that mad bugger Ellis again, because he'd turned the car right round and never even noticed.
Then were you going to sort of national meetings or meetings in London?
Yes, I was. I joined the National Association, which you couldn't do then until you became a consultant. And I think I joined as an associate member because mm-hmm. I was an impure urologist. But I used to greatly enjoy the meetings of the section of urology
mm-hmm.
of the RSM.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I used, in when I was a lad in London, I used to say, these people come up from all over the place. And I am amazed, really, because we didn't always get a particularly good program. But one of the chaps who I greatly admired and was hugely helpful to me when I came to Oxford was Conrad Latto, who mm-hmm. was a general surgeon but did all the urology in Reading.
Right.
And he used to come up to the RSM with an armful of X-rays and ask the various people, particularly Alec Badenoch, my boss.
Yes, right.
And he... I know I was impressed that he would come all the way up to London for this.
Yes.
And but when I came to Oxford, I realised exactly why they came up, because you were very isolated.
Yeah, very lonely, in a sense.
Quite
yes.
lonely.
Yes.
And you needed someone to share your yes. problems with.
Yes. So did you talk to John Badenoch? Because he was a cousin of your
yes.
chap, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Sort of, yes, I got on very well with yes. John Badenoch.
Yes. I agree.
And he was a nice man.
Yes.
Very good physician.
Yes.
There wasn't much treatment you could do for cancer of the prostate in those days. I'm not sure there's much you can do now, but I think it's one of these diseases that's fairly grossly overtreated.
Right.
And I thought it was grossly overtreated in the States when I was there.
Uh-huh. When did you become not a general physician? Did you give that up eventually?
I was never a physician. I was a
sorry,
general
surgeon. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's mm-hmm. fine. I gave it up when 7 years after I came to Oxford,
yes.
I was working flat out, and it was generally recognised that I couldn't cope. And so we appointed Griff Fellows.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have facilities for him in Oxford. So I made a joint appointment with Stoke Mandeville,
mm-hmm.
and he did the spinal unit in Stoke Mandeville.
Oh, yes.
And that was an interesting story in itself, in that the advert, it said, they wanted a urologist for Stoke Mandeville.
Right.
And they didn't specify that it was for the spinal injuries. And I had severe flack from several general surgeons
yeah.
in Stoke Mandeville. And I can remember driving out with a chap called Pledger, who used to work for the... what would it be called? What Alex Gatherer became?
A community physician or public health.
Yeah, public health.
Yes.
And this chap went out, and one of a chap who'd been my registrar, what was his name? And he attacked me. Because he said this advert had appeared, and they were all up in arms.
Yeah.
Geoffrey Hadfield and what was the chap's name? Can't remember. But they attacked me, and quite clearly wanted to protect their own private practice.
You bet.
And there was this chap, Pledger, who I knew I'd found out had 6 children, and he was working on a salary. So I just said to him, well, you see what the sort of thing you're up against.
Yeah, yeah. And then once, and then at the time Griff came, were you both entirely urological, or was Griff doing general?
No, Griff never did any general, right. But he was a well-trained urologist, and he did the spinal injuries unit at Stoke Mandeville, not the general surgical.
No.
And he used to do that 2.5 days a week or something. He had 4 sessions there and 5 sessions in Oxford or something like that.
But you gave up general surgery at that time too.
I gave up general surgery like 7 years after.
Yes, yes. Mm. And looking back, have you ever worked as hard as in those 7 years?
I don't think I did. I mean, I worked longer hours because when I was a houseman at UCH, you were on call for 6 months, full stop.
Yeah.
But I worked very, very hard, and my father used to say she'd brought our children up as a one-parent family.
Yes.
But then we all did.
We were always on call. Yes.
And never off call.
And how did you get on with the various professors?
Well, I got on well with... I always got on well personally with Alison, although he was quite a strange man.
Yeah.
George Pickering, I got on quite well with him, although I can remember one time he referred me a patient and did what was necessary, and this chap then went back to Pickering, and I think he was a private patient, and then George Pickering said, well, you better go in the ward now. And this chap didn't like it.
No. So when did you give up the research sessions?
Well, the research sessions were they carried on for several years, and one had to produce the research to justify them, although I wasn't being paid any money. But the real change in my research came when Alison Brading, with whom I had a great deal of contact, I realized I was too busy as a practicing clinician to even supervise research. And one of my research chaps, a chap called Tim Philp, who I saw the other evening, and he was doing a thesis on cooling the bladder as possible cause treatment for bladder instability.
Mm-hmm.
And he went along and saw Alison Brading. Now, she had succeeded a remarkable lady who was in the pharmacology department and who was a world expert on smooth muscle.
Yes, Bulbring, Edith Bulbring.
Edith Bulbring.
You're off.
We were talking about Edith Bulbring. Yeah. And I went to see Edith Bulbring, and I talked about the problem of the unstable bladder, and she suddenly went very cold on me, and I had no idea why she did that, but I didn't think I could make much progress. But later, when she retired, I was asked to see her. She was in Professor Morris's ward. And so I think it's only when you find out the whole history of people that you learn to explain changes in attitudes.
Absolutely, like quite agree. So Alison Brading, then.
Yes, and Alison Brading has been a great cooperator, and I used to, when Edith Bulbring retired and Alison became reader, then I got a real cooperation going, and I used to supply her with raw young surgical registrars, and she's a very stern lady, Alison Brading, and she used to turn them into proper scientists.
Great.
Was something I could never have done.
Well, no, but good for everybody, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the pattern that has been gradually taking place in Oxford ever since.
Yes.
There still isn't enough cooperation between the medical school and the university. I agree.
I agree. So now, you were never fancying yourself doing transplantation of the kidney?
Well, we did the first transplantation. I was involved in that. And this was before Peter Morris arrived. And I've got the cutting from the Oxford Times, Oxford's first kidney switch, it's called. And it was a young girl from Abingdon who'd had, and we'd been working up to this and practicing. John Ledingham was the lead physician. Patterson.
Yes, he was a plastic surgeon.
Plastic surgeon.
Yes, sure.
And now, John Ledingham was a physician.
Vascular, or?
Yes, Alf
Gunning. Yes,
Alf Gunning did the thing, and what's his name? He's got a beard now, and I see him walking around Oxford. He's still alive.
What, a pathologist or a radiologist?
No, Patterson.
Oh yes, no, he's got a beard. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. What's his name? First name?
I'm just trying to think, because I used to know. I know. Tim or no, I forget. And I. And that went well, your transplant?
Well, it went all right. The patient died, but I'm not sure the transplant produced much urine.
Right.
And then after that, they clearly needed to do something about it, and they appointed Peter Morris, and I was quite glad to back out of it, although I used to go and harvest the kidneys when I remember going Northampton and Swindon harvesting kidneys.
Were you on the appointments committee for Peter?
I don't think I was. I think Tim Till was the surgical presence. I was on the appointments committee for Des Oliver.
Right.
Who was appointed as a
renal physician, ran the transplant, the dialysis unit.
Yeah, that's right. But I don't think I was. No, I don't think I was on Peter Morris's appointment. No, I'm sure I wasn't. That was a university thing, and
yes,
they wouldn't have had a lowly plumber on
them. They were funny about that.
Yes.
And then,
although I was on appointments committee for an anaesthetist,
right,
John Henville, who lives in Woodstock now, and you would never get a surgeon on an anaesthetics appointment committee now.
Really? Right. Okay. Then at some stage you were what, president of the Urological Association?
Yes, that wasn't till a lot later.
Right.
I've been president of both urological organisations in the country. First of all, I was president of the section of urology of the Royal Society of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was president of BAUS in 92 to 94. And following retirement, I became president of the Medical Defence Union.
Right, yes.
Which has always been a big interest of mine.
Well, that must have given you a lot of insights into what went on.
Huge amounts.
Yes. But how do you think the Oxford School was developing? Do you think...
Well, we used to talk to this about the dinners, that it had a big lift up in 66.
Yes.
When there were six new appointments.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Duffy, Malcolm and myself in surgery, mm-hmm. and yourself, John and Peter Slide in the Fenton. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can trace the rise in eminence of Oxford Medicine and Surgery from that 66, I think.
And from getting the Cambridge students across.
Oh,
that
yes.
made a difference, I
yes,
think.
Yes, I think that made a huge difference. Yes. It was... that's been great.
Are there anything, ways in which you feel Oxford went wrong later on, you know, during your time?
No, it was always that we were constraints, financial constraints. Mm-hmm. And I think given the facilities, we did pretty well.
Mm-hmm. How did you enjoy the move to the John Radcliffe?
Well, I didn't actually move to the John Radcliffe.
Right.
The surgeon who did the first move was Malcolm Gough.
Right.
And I've always maintained a strong base in the Churchill Hospital. And it's now a very strong base because I started urology on a part-time basis, being a general surgeon.
Mm.
And David Cranston was in here the other evening, and he told me that he thinks there are about 12.
Yes,
12 now.
What about the hatted wards? Were they falling to bits around your head?
They were all right.
Mm.
I can remember going to see patients in the hatted wards. And they were just wards as far as we were concerned.
Yeah, no, indeed. They all seemed to be all right to me.
I thought they were all right.
Yes.
Mm.
Now, what do you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I'm not sure. I've written out... I'm writing my own story now, and I've written out quite a lot... Because my great-grandfather did it for his life in 1902.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time last year typing that out.
Right.
Some of it's in the last round.
So did you grow up in Manchester, in that area? Or?
No, at Lancaster.
Right, Lancaster.
Manchester was the big town to when you wanted to go and see a specialist. My great uncle had been professor of surgery.
Yes, I thought so. Yes,
in Manchester,
yes, yes.
And he was known as Fat Smith because he one time three housemen got together and put his Sam Brown belt. He was a great. Territorial Army man.
Right.
He'd been out to South Africa and three housemen got their his Sam Brown belt round them and buckled it up.
Yes.
And Hugh Brown, I don't know if you ever knew Hugh Brown, but I used to play real tennis with him.
Right.
And his great uncle or grandfather had invented the Sam Brown belt.
Wow.
Because he had a wonky hand, and he needed this belt so he could get his pistol out.
Yeah, sure. What made you train in London rather than in Manchester?
Well, I thought it would be. I was at school in York.
Yes.
At a Quaker school.
Oh, right.
And I went to I didn't know where to go. My great uncle died years before I was born, and so I went, applied to a lot of hospitals. I don't think I applied to Manchester, but I applied to London hospitals, and the only one that they had an exam for was University College. And there were a couple called Abercrombie, both on the faculty, and they decided that it would be a good idea to have an examination. And I always felt that it wasn't, they never really followed that up, because there was an anaesthetist who'd been up in Manchester, who came here, who did a lot of follow-up of what had happened to people in various echelons. And I would have thought this was a very good way of finding out what had happened.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, the trouble is, it's such a long time scale.
And how much of the Oxford countryside did you see in the end?
Well, we lived just south of Oxford in Wootton when we came here. And, I think Oxford's the most wonderful place to practice.
Yeah.
Because the students are so good and your colleagues are so good. My contact with the MDU has made me realise there are a lot of very indifferent doctors around.
Because the GPs are so good here, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Quite
exceptional.
Yes. Okay, Joe, well, have you had enough?
Well,
anything else you want to say?
No, I don't think. I'm very glad about the timing of my life.
Yes.
Because I was born in 1931, and I came into the health service, so I missed the war. And then I had TB and I couldn't get called up.
That was of the chest, was it?
Yes. Yes. And I lived through, I got TB originally at school with a pleural effusion, and then it relapsed when I was a student, and the students were all put under the care of the senior physician, who was a man called Andrew Morland, and he didn't believe in these newfangled antibiotics. So after I qualified, I was sent home to Lancaster and told that I should not do a house surgeon's job because it meant spending long hours in theatre. Never did, but it certainly doesn't now. But I was very frustrated, and I then was applying for all the jobs at the back of the BMJ. And there was a locum job advertised in a place called St. Alphege's, Greenwich. And I applied for this and got it. It was a terrible hospital. I told some nurse to put up normal saline and went into the side room and found her spooning salt into the drip bottle. It was quite a good place to learn. And then there was a job advertised at the Miller Hospital, which was a very nice voluntary hospital just down the road from St. Alphege's.
Right.
And so I applied for a house physician's job there and got it. And that was a wonderful job for a would-be surgeon because it had skins, cardiology and neurology for the first half.
Right.
And chests and children for the second half of the job.
Yeah.
So that was a marvellous job to have.
Yes. Now, I'm surprised Andrew didn't get you some antibiotics. Or was that later?
Well, this was later, you see, because I then changed to... He retired, and I changed to his junior, a man called Howard Nicholson. Mm-hmm. And the third one was Peter Heath.
Oh, yes, of the test.
Yes, Heath test. Well, it was his father.
Right, okay.
He was in Wales. And best of all, I met Mafalda there.
Yes, absolutely. Very good. A very good note to end on, Joe. Thank you very much indeed.
Not a bit.
Great.